cross-hilt of silvered bronze. This he drew forth all in haste, and offered the hilt to the archmage as a liegeman to his prince. The archmage did not put out his hand to touch the sword hilt. He looked at it and at Arryn. "That is yours, not mine," he said, "and you are no man's servant. But my father said that I might stay on Roke until I learned what this evil is, and maybe some mastery. I have no skill, I don't think I have any power, but there were mages among my forefathers. If I might in some way learn to be of use to you."
"Before your ancestors were mages," the archmage said, "they were kings."
He stood up and came with silent, vigorous step to Arryn, and taking the boy's hand, made him rise.
"I thank you for your offer of service, and though I do not accept it now, yet I may, when we have taken counsel on these matters. The offer of a generous spirit is not one to refuse lightly. Nor is the sword of the son of Morred to be lightly turned aside. Now go. The lad who brought you here will see that you eat and bathe and rest. Go on." And he pushed Arryn lightly between the shoulder blades, a familiarity no one had ever taken before, and which the young prince would have resented from anyone else. But he felt the archmage's touch as a thrill of glory, for Arryn had fallen in love. He had been an active boy, delighting in games, taking pride and pleasure in the skills of body and mind, apt at his duties of ceremony and governing, which were neither light nor simple. Yet he had never given himself entirely to anything. All had come easily to him, and he had done all easily. It had all been a game, and he had played at loving. But now the depths of him were wakened, not by a game or dream, but by honor, danger, wisdom, by a scarred face and a quiet voice and a dark hand holding, careless of its power, the staff of yew that bore near the grip, in silver set in the black wood, the lost rune of the kings. So the first step out of childhood is made all at once, without looking before or behind, without caution, and nothing held in reserve. Forgetting courtly farewells, he hurried to the doorway, awkward, radiant, obedient. And Ged, the archmage, watched him go. Ged stood a while by the fountain under the ash tree, then raised his face to the sun-washed sky. "A gentle messenger for bad news," he said half aloud, as if talking to the fountain. It did not listen, but went on talking in its own silver tongue, and he listened to it a while. Then going to another doorway which Arryn had not seen, and which indeed very few eyes would have seen, no matter how close they looked, he said, "Master doorkeeper." A little man of no age appeared. Young he was not, so that one had to call him old, but the word did not suit him. His face was dry and colored like ivory, and he had a pleasant smile that made long curves in his cheeks. "What's the matter, Ged?" said he. For they were alone, and he was one of the seven persons in the world who knew the archmage's name. The others were the master namer of Roke, and Ogion the Silent, the wizard of Rhaealbi, who long ago on the mountain of Gaunt had given Ged that name, and the White Lady of Gaunt, Tanar of the Ring, and a village wizard in Ifish called Vetch. And in Ifish again, a house carpenter's wife, mother of three girls, ignorant of all sorcery but wise in other things, who was called Yarrow. And finally, on the other side of Earthsea, in the farthest west, two dragons, Orm Embar and Kalesin. "We should meet tonight," the archmage said. "I'll go to the Patterner, And I'll send to Kurram Karmeruk so that he'll put his lists away and let his students rest one evening and come to us, if not in flesh. Will you see to the others?
Aye, said the doorkeeper, smiling, and was gone.
And the archmage also was gone. And the fountain talked to itself, all serene and never ceasing in the sunlight of early spring. Somewhere to the west of the great house of Roke, and often somewhat south of it, the imminent grove is usually to be seen. There is no place for it on maps, and there is no way to it except for those who know the way to it. But even novices and townsfolk and farmers can see it, always at a certain distance, a wood of high trees whose leaves have a hint of gold in their greenness, even in the spring. And they consider, the novices, the townsfolk, the farmers, that the grove moves about in a mystifying manner. But in this they are mistaken, for the grove does not move. Its roots are the roots of being. It is all the rest that moves. Ged walked over the fields from the great house. He took off his white cloak, for the sun was at noon. A farmer plowing a brown hillside raised his hand in salute, and Ged replied the same way. Small birds went up into the air and sang. The sparkweed was just coming into flower in the fallows and beside the roads. Far up, a hawk cut a wide arc on the sky. Ged glanced up and raised his hand again. Down shot the bird in a rush of wind.